And welcome to a Juno Afternoon. My name is Jamie Waste. I'll be your host this afternoon. John Neary will be in the studio to highlight tonight's presentation about bears and people at the Mendenhall Glacier. John Smith, high school teacher, will be here to talk about the science fair along with one of his star pupils. Betty Kapler, one of AWARE's four women of distinction, will be here to talk about Saturday's banquet. And we'll get a preview of Juno Lyric Opera's upcoming production of Man of La Mancha. Writer's Almanac, Bird Notes, music, and much more coming up here, right here on KTOO News in Juno. And if you missed the show live at 3 today, it's also available at 4 p.m. on KRNN.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native leaders say they're frustrated with the results of recent roundtable discussions on the issue of missing and murdered Aboriginal women and girls in Canada. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, they expected much more.
The talks involved federal and provincial political leaders along with Aboriginal leaders. What they did get from the talks was a framework committing to more talks on prevention and awareness, safety in First Nations communities, and policing in the justice system. There was also an agreement to meet again before the end of next year. Perry Bellegarde is the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations. Bellegarde said frustration was evident around the table, mainly when it came to calls for a national inquiry into missing and murdered Aboriginal women. The Conservative government of Prime Minister Stephen Harper has committed $25 million over 5 years to continue plans to reduce violence against Aboriginal women and girls. But Bellegarde says that's not enough money.
It's just scratching the surface. If you're going to deal with the systemic problems, if you're going to deal with poverty, if you're going to deal with homelessness, if you're going to deal with the need for safe shelter, where are those key strategic investments now? They're not there. And the point we made, this was an action-oriented process, where it supposedly was. It doesn't take the place of the push for a national inquiry.
But the government has been firm in its opposition to a national inquiry. The two federal cabinet ministers who did attend the roundtable held a separate news conference after the event, which rankled First Nations leaders even more. And one Native woman whose daughter's remains were found on convicted killer Robert Picton's farm in British Columbia said she was particularly upset that Prime Minister Stephen Harper refused to attend the meeting, adding that once again he's shown that he doesn't care. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Tribal leaders fear sequestration. Those indiscriminate budget cuts may come back next year unless lawmakers can reach a bipartisan deal to avert it. Matt Laszlo has a story from Washington.
Budget cuts are a real challenge for lawmakers, especially when there are sequester cuts, which lopped millions of dollars in every area of the budget. The chief of the Delaware Tribe of Indians, Chet Brooks, says the across-the-board cuts imposed by Congress in 2011 are on every tribal leader's mind.
Talk about sequestration is the most concern to us. I don't know if it's going to get resolved or not.
Amber Ebarb, a budget policy analyst at NCAI, says there may be some optimism that the president's budget seeks to do away with sequester cuts, but she isn't seeing a clear path forward.
As we've heard from members of the appropriations subcommittees for Interior and Commerce, Justice, Science, that they want to help fund these initiatives in Indian country to, you know, support tribal nation building and self-determination, all these really good goals. But really it comes down to whether Congress can come together to address sequestration for FY16. And if they don't, then it'll be very difficult.
Lawmakers in both parties are scrambling to find a way to avoid another round of sequestration. But many officials fear those steep budget cuts are coming back next year. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
California Indians and scholars are set to discuss the impending canonization of Junipero Serra. A day-long symposium at the University of California, Riverside is scheduled for March 13th. Many Native Americans in California voiced concerns after Pope Francis announced in January he plans to make the Catholic priest a saint. Sarah was a Franciscan priest and president of the Sacred Expedition of 1769. He helped create the mission system, which led to the decimation of the state's indigenous population in the 18th and 19th centuries. Sarah is viewed by some as a pioneer and religious icon. Others say he's responsible for genocide. Organizers of the symposium say it's an opportunity for California Indians with different views to share their perspectives. The event is open to the public. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
The Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce's Convention and Tourism Department welcomes to Albuquerque the Gathering of Nations to the UNM Pitt, April 24th. Information on services and the Gathering of Nations at ahcnm.org.
When you file online for your PFD, every Alaskan can support National Native News. Just use PIC, click, give, and select KNBA-FM Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Welcome to a Juno afternoon. Good afternoon, folks. In the studio here at KTOO, we have John Neary, who's the director of the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, and Patricia Weary, the sponsoring organization. You're going to have to remind me again the name of the sponsoring organization.
Okay. We're Alaska Wildlife Alliance, and we are the Southeast chapter of that.
Well, welcome both of you to KTOO, and we're here, or you folks are here tonight to talk about, today, to talk about tonight's presentation out at the Mendenhall Glacier.
No. Wildlife Wednesdays happen at Thunder Mountain.
Okay. Tell us about Wildlife Wednesdays.
Thanks for having us, Jamie. Yeah, that's an important point because people do know me as the Mendenhall director, and we do have our Fireside series chats, and this week we'll have a great show on Friday. But tonight's show will be at Thunder Mountain High School, as Pat said, at 7 o'clock. And it's going to be about Mendenhall bears. And the way this came about was Pat O'Brien, who also volunteers with Pat Wary here, asked me last summer if I could do a presentation about bears, because she'd been to one of my bear presentations. I said, sure. And she said, you know, the subject could be up to you, and we'll do it in September. And I said, okay, we'll just sort of talk about what happened at the Mendenhall over the course of the summer. That'd be great. And then we had hardly any bears over the course of the summer at Mendenhall. It was kind of a story in itself. Mm-hmm. It didn't really warrant a presentation, so we kind of put it off till the spring. And now I'll be talking about something related but slightly different, and it's titled Improving the Experience for Both Bears and People at Mendenhall.
So give us a preview. Well, we don't want to give away the show or the presentation, but, I mean, just give people a sense of what they might learn about tonight if they turn out for this.
Yes, and so Pat asked that I talk about both bear safety and just facts about bears, you know, because they're already coming out of their dens now, right, because it's been warm and there's been some reports. But soon, you know, they'll be out in full. And so people need to be reminded, of course, about that fact and then some of the safety things. So I'll talk about that. But I come from a perspective of why bears do what they do. I really try to explain things to people about what motivates animals, you know, why they make choices to do things. And then after that, I'll move into sort of the Mendenhall-specific situation, really digging into what do the bears at Mendenhall look for, what do they find, and how do they get along with all those people out there?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a remarkable management challenge out at the glacier, which is being handled amazingly well. I mean, the infrastructure that's out there now to make that experience far, you know, more safer for people and enjoyable for people, it's come a long way. So hats off to the folks involved with that.
Well, thank you very much, Jamie. I think that I would want to take credit for myself, because really those platforms, when they were put in 2005, were really a game changer. And I'll talk about that tonight, but you might remember, if you were out there before that time, that seeing a bear wasn't such a pleasant event. It was explosive. It was scary in the brush. A little adrenaline, yeah. Suddenly the platforms went in, and voila, there's a little bit of distance, a nice railing between, and the bears became more comfortable. The people mellowed out, and everybody got along better. That's really sort of the heart of what I'm going to talk to about tonight about is how to do more of that.
You mentioned that last summer that maybe there wasn't as much bear activity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just any clues in hindsight? Is there any sense of what that was all about?
Well, think back to last May. Do you remember? Remember all the flowers blooming, how mild it was? It got up into the 70s, I think, even, or at least it felt like it.
Oh, spring?
Yeah, I remember that. All the
fruit
trees were blooming, and we had it was an amazing month. Well, the berries did really, really well last year, and they started early, and they were profuse. They were everywhere. And my personal theory was because there was so many alternative food sources, coupled with a salmon run that wasn't really even as much as average. It was probably below average, that sockeye run. So when you add those two together, the bears just chose to be up on the slopes most of the summer. And then when the berries got exhausted, which happened, even up high, you might remember going up to Eagle Crest in the normal time of late September, and there was like nothing left. Well, the bears found the same thing. So we found October during the silver run, several bears were there that we hardly saw most of the summer, so it was kind of a late appearance.
Mm-hmm. So before we got on the microphone here, we chatted just briefly about dens.
Mm.
I mean, obviously there are dens in the Mendenhall Glacier area because every spring you see sows with their cubs and similar ranges or what have you.
Yes.
And I've always wondered about, you know, people, a lot of recreation-minded people tromping around in the woods around here this time of year, not a lot of snow on the ground. And when you come upon a den, if you come upon a den, there's this natural curiosity about, oh, a bear den. What's your advice to people?
Well, you know, I would be just as curious as you, right? Because I have seen dens, certainly, but I've never seen them with bears in them. So the times I've been up to them is when a radio collar was dropped right near the den because mm-hmm. the neck got too skinny and the bear squeezed out of the collar and I was going up, you know, with fish and game to retrieve it or something. But if I were to come upon a den in the middle of winter, I would be cautious because I know that the bear isn't really truly hibernating and they can in fact rouse from their sleep, that torpor, and come out and investigate, you know, some sort of disturbance. This has certainly happened, and it's probably more problematic with brown bears than with black bears, but I would still be a little concerned. But for the most part, you know, black bears are pretty forgiving. There's a number of stories of biologists that have gone to black bear dens and, you know, handled cubs and the female being right nearby. Mm-hmm. I don't want to imply we should be doing that,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, I wouldn't want to over-dramatize the danger either. It's something to be aware of. Mostly, I would stay away from respect for the animal, trying to not give her yet one more thing to worry about when she's under such nutritional stress, trying to raise those little cubs up to be big enough to make it in the world.
And I think for many people, you grow up with this image of a bear den as this cave, you know, this thing that you would walk into or what have you. But my guess is here in Southeast and maybe in many places in bear country, but what would be your typical den? It might surprise people to find out that it's either rocks or trees. Or could you describe the kinds of dens in the area?
Yes, you know, there's a study on Prince of Wales Island that showed over 90% of them being trees of some sort, whether they were dead trees or logs on the ground that they could hollow into. And I have a number of photos of dens tonight in the presentation. The favorite one up Upper Steep Creek is the base of a big tree, say a big spruce on a steep hillside, and has got that spreading, buttressing root system that has a slight rot point in it, and the bear can dig into the rot, dig into the ground under that tree, and it's fairly dry. So that's really what the bear is looking for, is that dryness over the course of the winter.
Mm-hmm. Patricia, the program, you want to just tell the audience a little bit more about the program? You said there's one more in the series?
Yes, we do Wildlife Wednesdays throughout the winter, start in October and end about in April, and we have one more. And Riley Woodward is going to be talking about small Alaska mammals at that one.
Mm-hmm. Woodford.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's next Wednesday?
And no, we do it the first Wednesday of each month.
Okay.
So it'll be the first Wednesday. I can't remember the date for it.
That's all right.
In April, but yeah.
And that's, again, at Thunder Mountain in
right.
the library.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Very good. So, John, before we wrap this up, anything else that you really wanted to kind of share with the audience today about tonight's presentation to pique their curiosity to get them to come?
Yeah. You know, the title says Improving the Experience for Bears and People. And you might wonder, how could we really improve for bears, things that, you know, nature provides them quite well? And that's what I really hope to talk about is we've got something interesting happening out at Mendenhall. It's called climate change. We've got glaciers receding, streams changing, things growing, and we could really do a better job of thinking about all those from the perspective of both the animal and the people, because the people are coming in great numbers to see them.
And for locals, it's this wonderful gift that we live with and maybe take for granted all the time. We get to see bears, so this management challenge at the glacier to make it safe for visitors and for us and for locals.
Indeed. Yeah. That's well said.
Well, thank you both. Any, Patricia, anything else you wanted to say?
Well, I need to acknowledge that the Wildlife Wednesdays are put on by the Southeast Branch of Alaska Wildlife Alliance, and sometimes people don't associate the two things together, but this is the educational thing that we do for that agency.
Very good. John Neary, Patricia Wary, thank you very much to both of you for coming into the studio this afternoon. I hope you get a nice turnout this evening. And this is 7 o'clock tonight at Thunder Mountain High School in the library, and it's for free, correct?
It's free. It's open to everybody. We serve cookies.
Well, no, there you go. It's always a good hook. Thank you very much to both of you.
Thank you,
Jamie.
You're welcome.
All right.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 4th of March, 2015. It's the anniversary of the admission of Vermont to the Union in 1791. It was the 14th state to join. Vermont, which for its first 200 years voted Republican in every single presidential election except 1964, when it voted for Lyndon Johnson. But since 1992, it's voted Democratic in every presidential election. It competes with New Hampshire for being the least religious state in the Union. Only half of Vermonters say they believe in God, compared with about 70% of the rest of the country. It's the birthday of the novelist Thomas Stribling, born Clifton, Tennessee, 1881. He started out writing pulp fiction for magazines, detective stories, science fiction. Loved Venezuela. He wrote three novels set there in the 20s, and then won the Pulitzer Prize with his novel The Store, a satire of the Jim Crow South. Thomas Stribling was a contemporary of Faulkner and Hemingway, and his books sold better than theirs. Between the end of World War I and the beginning of World War II, Thomas Stribling was America's best-selling author. 1797, on this day, John Adams was inaugurated second president of the United States, succeeding George Washington, beating out his rival Thomas Jefferson. The ceremony took place on a sunny day, Philadelphia, Congress Hall. Adams, dressed in a gray suit, a short, frumpy man, Jefferson, tall and elegant, in a long blue frock coat, Washington, dressed in black velvet. Franklin D. Roosevelt inaugurated on this day, 1933, in the midst of the Depression. Most Americans didn't know how crippled he was from polio, and he tried to keep it a secret, so in order for him to ascend the steps to the podium to take the oath of office, he went up a series of ramps that were hidden behind barriers, walked the last few yards leaning on the arm of his son James, and made it look easy, even though it took great strength. His inaugural address included the famous phrase, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." Here's a poem for today by Jeffrey Harrison entitled "The Day Nothing Happened," with a quote from a news item: "British computer scientists have determined that April 11, 1954 was the most boring day of the 20th century. On that day in history, history took a day off. Current events were uneventful. Breaking news never broke. Nobody of any import was born or died. If you were born that day, bask in the inverted glory of your unimportance. No milestones, no disasters. The most significant thing going on was a golf tournament, the Masters. It was a Sunday. In Washington, President Eisenhower, whose very name induces sleep, practiced his putt on the carpet of the Oval Office, a little white ball crossing and recrossing the presidential seal like one of Jupiter's moons or a hypnotist's watch. On the radio, Perry Como was putting everyone into a coma. But the very next day, in New York City, Bill Haley and his Comets recorded Rock Around the Clock, and a few young people began to regain consciousness while history, like Polyphemus waking from a one-day slumber, stumbled out of his cave, blinked his giant eye, and peered around for something to destroy. The Day Nothing Happened by Jeffrey Harrison from Into Daylight, published by Tupelo Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. And by Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
The Ends of the Earth airs on KTOO Public Television Wednesday night at 7. This documentary takes us into Alaska's most remote wildernesses and up-close encounters with the wildlife that makes our state unique.
So many great community institutions here in the capital city, and the high school science fair, regional science fair, I believe, has been one of those institutions for many, many years. Science teacher John Smith from Juno Douglas High School is in the studio, along with Raven Ward, who is one of last year's winners of the science fair. They're both in the studio. Welcome to both of you. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Jonathan, why don't you give us a little bit, just an overview, a little bit of history about what the science fair is, and then we'll make sure we talk to Raven here.
Okay. Well, the fair was started here in town in 1994, so it's 21 years old. It was started by Bill Leedy and Nancy Waterman, who are still kicking around in town here. Mm-hmm. In fact, they're one of our big donors this year, as usual. And it started out with a handful of projects, four projects out of the Mendenhall Mall. And it has grown. Last year, we had over 140 projects at the fair. So it's grown quite significantly over time. At some point in that process, it became a regional fair. We are affiliated with the Intel International Science Fair system, which means that our winners go on to the International Science Fair, which Raven did last year. So we have to play by their rules, and one of the things that means is that our fair is open to all of Southeast Alaska, so we have participants from in various places in Southeast. Most of the participants, however, will be from Thunder Mountain and JDHS.
So last year you had 140.
We did.
That's a
we
lot.
Did. Yeah, it was a packed house. We're going to have a significantly smaller this year, but we're going to be in a slightly smaller venue this year for only the second time in the fair's history. We'll be out at Thunder Mountain in the auxiliary gym out there. I think it's going to be a nice size fair for people to be able to get around and look at all the projects. We've got 58 projects this year.
Mm-hmm. And before I ask Raven a few questions here, so how is it judged? I mean, it's how does a winner get declared?
Well, you know, that is a lot like, you know, watching sausage get made. You know, you want to eat it, but you don't want to know what goes on behind the scenes. But there are a lot of volunteers from town, a lot of science-based volunteers from town that come in and give up their time on Friday night and then again on Saturday morning. To judge the students. They're judged on a variety of criteria, a notebook that they put together. So a lot of times the judges will know a lot about the projects before they even meet the students, mm-hmm. because they'll have read through their notebooks. They're judged on their display, and of course they're judged on their presentation. And every student gets at least 6 to 10 judges. And that's the first tier of judging. And then if the judges caucus together. So it's not just, you know, they don't just give a score. They give scores, but then they also caucus together so that the cream rises to the top. And the best of projects will then go on to a second round of judging, which is judged on Sunday. And the winners from there go on to the international fair.
Raven, last year you were one of those winners, and you actually went on to the international fair. But for starters, what was your project a year ago?
Last year I did a project on genetic differentiation of two populations of capelin around Alaska.
Capelin?
Yes, they're a small fish, and they live in a lot of places around the world, and a lot of people don't know about them around Alaska because they're not a food source, but they are a food source for many of the animals we eat, including salmon and other things such as whales.
And what led you to choose that topic?
I worked on looking at this topic out at NOAA, and it was going to be explored by scientists at NOAA, and I was the first part of this experiment, and it continues with more populations around Alaska.
So when you figured out what you wanted to do and you knew you wanted to be a part of the fair, how much work is involved? I mean,
It is a lot of work. last year, I did almost 40 hours of data collection alone, and that didn't include making a poster or all the preparation and writing the pieces that went into the notebook.
And then you were one of the winners.
Yes.
So congratulations.
Thank you.
It's quite the honor to be recognized for all of not just the work, but the results, the product. I mean, to be judged and be declared kind of one of the best projects. And then you got to go on to a bigger competition. Why don't you tell folks about that?
Intel ISEF in Los Angeles was an amazing experience. Not only the science projects that each of these kids did around the world, but meeting people from so many different countries was mind-blowing. I met people from Taiwan and India, and that was in itself a completely new experience for me.
And when you're at this event, do you get to go around and check out what everybody else has done too? Or is it just so busy with being one of the participants that there's not enough time to do that?
There wasn't enough time for me to see all the projects. Honestly, I could have spent a week just looking at other people's work. Afterwards, I did go around with Maddie Handley, who also came to Intel as one of the winners, and we looked at people's abstracts, and we did talk to a couple people. One girl from Peru, she gave us her speech, but it was in Spanish. And so Maddie, having some experience with Spanish, was able to translate a little bit for me, and that was really cool.
What year in high school are you?
I'm a sophomore currently.
So your freshman year, you were a winner, and obviously you're back for more. You're entering again. So what's this year's project?
This year I'm part of a team, and we're working on a project looking at how habitat affects aggression and activity levels in red king crab.
And again, what was the inspiration for that idea?
We've both been interested in marine biology for a long time, and so this project really, it looks at so many different aspects about how species that are important to humans can be looked at and scientifically to see how they can be reintroduced. Red king crab actually has had many stock crashes recently, and so our project looks at how we might be able to raise survival rates in hatcheries.
Do you see yourself pursuing science?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd hope to have a career in science.
When you think about college, you're thinking, that's my major, that's the direction I want to go in.
I'm not completely sure what branch, but I would like to have science in some part of my adult life.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that a lot of the people on the board of the science fair are really proud of is that we have enough data right now after 21 years of fair to see how many students have actually been influenced to go on in science. Mm-hmm. In fact, currently I took over this year as president of the fair temporarily. Our president had to leave suddenly, but it looks like the next person in line to run the fair here in town was actually a competitor who was a student of mine many years ago. And if you go out to NOAA, no facilities. The joint's loaded with old science fair students. And you were talking earlier about the judges. It's getting to the point where almost half of our judges are ex-science fair students who have come back with degrees in science and are working here in town. I mean, one of the things we're blessed with is that we're a town of science. And so if we can get kids interested in it, it's one of the things that they can do to live here, to come back and live.
So I know when my kids were in high school, I remember I was not a judge, but I remember going to the science fair and getting a chance to actually see the projects and the exhibits and everything. So when is it? It's coming up?
It's coming up, and that's the main reason we're on the radio today, mm-hmm. Trying to get people interested to come out and see the variety of projects. So on Friday night, the students will be setting up, and there's an open house on Friday from 5 to 8, 5 p.m. to 8 o'clock, and the students many of them will want to be practicing their presentations and honing their skills. So if anybody wants to come down, that's the best time, actually. It's the students are relaxed at that point. They're not burnt out yet. You know, they haven't given their presentation over and over again. And they really want to talk about what all this work they've been doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like I said, there's 58 different projects, 58 different topics. There's something there for everybody. So, again, Friday night, 5 to 8. And then on Saturday, after the judging is over, from 12 to 1:30, we have another open house. It's a fine time to come. It tends to be a little bit more crowded. At that point, students are in that relieved stage. You know, they've gone through the process. Now it's up to the judges to find, you know, to tell them how well they did. But that's right after they've been judged.
Raven, do you still get nervous?
Yes, public speaking is always nerve-wracking for me.
Uh-huh. But are you looking forward to the competition itself?
I am.
Uh-huh. Very good. And Raven, just in terms of like appealing to your peers, your fellow students, to pique their interest in perhaps doing this? I mean, they all take science in high school, but is there anything that you would say to them about why this is a rewarding thing to do and you would encourage them to pursue it one of these years?
Science fair really gives you an opportunity to look at how scientists who have this as their profession work, and you get to work in the labs that they use, and often the projects reflect things that your mentor or other science fair or other scientists in the community actually do as a living, and so you get to learn so much about what it would be like to have that as your profession.
One of the things you left out there, too, was when you were asking earlier about last year at the International Fair. When I take the students to the International Fairs, there's a lot of attention given to them by a lot of corporations, including Intel and other corporations. And they do some pretty fantastic things for these kids. In fact, last year they shut down Universal Studios, the amusement park, and let the kids just wander freely throughout the amusement park. So the prizes that are available to these kids are pretty fantastic. And we've got some great donors in town. UAS gives a full-ride scholarship to one of the projects at this year's fair. So not only is there that internal reward of learning to understand science and all that, but there's also some external reward that the students can pick up along the way.
Raven, again, congratulations and good luck with your academic pursuits. And John, any final comments about the science fair for the general public to know before we switch gears here?
Yeah, I would feel remiss if I didn't thank our funders for just a second, BP and the school district and Alaska Airlines, Holland America. They really step up and give us a lot of funding to get the kids to be able to go to the international fair. And again, I'd like to just, you know, let everybody know that it is, if you've never seen the science fair in town, it is amazing what our high school students are capable of doing, and I promise you, you'll find something there to enjoy.
John Smith, Raven Ward, thank you very much, both of you, for coming into the studios today, and good luck with the competition.
Thank you. Thank you.
Do you think a scientist does to solve a problem found? Because many scientists are scientists, cause they're great problem solvers. There is a systematic way they go about most every day. It's methodical and it's logical, the scientific method.
A way to solve a problem.
A way.
The scientific method is a way to solve a problem.
To you, but the first thing that they always do is state the problem or ask a question so they know just what they're after. Then they review everything involved that might help get the problem solved by reading, researching, and gathering information.
A way to solve a problem. A way. The scientific method is a way to solve a problem.
Hypothesis, a possible solution. Then they use scientific tools to measure and test some variables and experiments, which are really meant to give more information.
A way to solve a problem. A way. The scientific method is a way to solve a problem.
A way to solve a problem.
And next on a Juneau Afternoon, very proud to have, excuse me, Betty Kapler, who is one of the four honorees this year for the 2015 Women of Distinction Honor that the AWARE organization has been putting on for quite a few years now. So Betty Kapler is in the studio. We're going to be chatting with her in just a moment. We also have Sarah Lynn Tabachnik from AWARE, Executive Director. And Sarah Lynn, good to see you. And maybe you can just give the audience a little, just a little history about Women of Distinction and the banquet coming up, and then we'll chat with Betty.
Thanks, Jamie. Women of Distinction has been happening for 19 years. The way it works is we've asked community members to nominate women in the community who they have seen doing outstanding work. They may be women who are volunteering, kind of unsung heroes, or they may be people who are more public. Each year, the board of directors at AWARE chooses four of the nominees and honors them at a gala event, a dinner, plated dinner, and silent auction. This year will be Saturday, just a few nights away, at Centennial Hall. We have doors opening at 5:30. From 5:30 to 7, there's silent auction, cash bar music by Tom Loker and Clay Good. And at 7 o'clock, we start our program, which includes each of the honorees speaking about what's brought her to this point or what inspires her.
Betty, congratulations on the honor.
Thank you.
And obviously, this is a kind of a lifetime. Just reading the little bit that I read about you, you've been taking care of people all your life.
Yes.
And that serves maybe as the foundation for what culminated in, you know, Helping Hands and some of the other things. But why don't you speak to your background and your story, and then we'll talk a little bit about the honor itself.
Well, it's just when we moved up here in 83 and stuff, I could see, you know, everybody, you know, struggling and stuff like that. And I started doing this volunteering, picking up stuff, and got it going. And we kept on and worked out of a station wagon and so forth. And then we got went into Helping Hands, got a Helping Hands nonprofit status, went United Way in 1990s and stuff. And then we got bigger and bigger and bigger as it went along.
what you observed was people were hungry, right?
That's right, yeah. There was, when we moved up here, it was really hard times. You had to fill out an application to get in an apartment, and then they would call you if they, you know, wanted to rent to you, and it was really tough. We lived in a campsite to begin with, and it rained every day, and it was really hard times, and I noticed how high stuff was, groceries and stuff, and people were struggling just as well as we were, you know, and today they still are. We aren't, but there's a lot of other people that are, you know.
So your observation of people who were hungry, families, mm-hmm. women, children, et cetera,
yes.
led you to do what? You started to quietly do certain things in the community.
Yes, I did, because, you know, I didn't really want it out in the public too much, because we didn't have no, we weren't really legal, I should say. Mm-hmm. But as the time went on, you know, you had to. You didn't have any choice.
And eventually your interests evolved into Helping Hands.
Yes.
Do you want to tell the public what Helping Hands is?
We're a nonprofit. We do Families Direct. We don't charge. We're all volunteers. We pick up 7 days a week, and we operate. We're open twice a week, and we do not ask for no info on income, nothing. It's on honor system. And if they come and they tell us they want food, we just let them come in and get food. And we've been operating this for quite a few years already, and it's been working out really well. I mean, all our funds is mostly through our own fundraisers, and we do get cash donations from different groups in town. And United Way has given us money, and other than that, it's all just our fundraisers, basically. I mean, we work hard. We're all volunteers, and we really get together and work on it, and, you know, it works out.
You're picking up food, right?
Yeah, from the grocery stores, yeah. Well, stuff that they would throw out, yeah.
Talk about that a little bit. I mean, you approach grocery stores, you approach whoever, and say, we believe you have something that can be used still in our community.
Yes. And really, the stuff is good for 5 to 7 days beyond. I mean, we don't use much beyond 7 days other than, you know, perishables. If it's canned stuff, it's different. But like perishables, it's like up to 7 days we can use it. So. Yeah, we watch it pretty close. We bring stuff in. We go through it. We don't just put it out as we get it in, you know. We go through it, sort it.
Mm-hmm.
If it has to be washed off a little bit, we produce, we wash it off and stuff, you know. So there's a lot of work involved in it.
And it's more than just food? It's clothing?
Yes.
I mean, it's expanded a little bit?
Yes, yeah. We do some clothing. People want to bring clothes up, we do. We do some home furnishings, like paint and stuff like that, we do get.
Mm-hmm.
And lights and things like that for people. So it's really helped them out.
And how many years has Helping Hands been in existence?
I've done this since 1983, but Helping Hands, I think we probably about in 1990 maybe.
So for the first 7 years, you were just doing it as a citizen, just as a concerned citizen.
Right. You wouldn't do that now.
And I'm sure well received by people when asked, can you help?
Yeah. So it's been working out. So.
And then today, in addition, you work full-time, is that correct?
Yes, I do. I work at Wildflower Court full-time, yeah.
So you're working full-time at Wildflower Court, and you're still running Helping Hands as a volunteer.
Yeah, it doesn't pay nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I got to pay my bills.
So you have a short work week.
Yeah, it's like Helping Hands is 40 hours plus even,
mm-hmm.
you know, because on my days off, I pick up and I'm there all day, and I'm there in the evening, and, you know, and a lot of times fundraisers, you know, you're there all day long, 2 days straight, you know, 3 days straight, you know. So it's like 40-hour week volunteer job.
So when you were contacted that you were an honoree, what ran through your mind or your heart?
Well,
you know, what was your reaction?
I was just overwhelmed. I didn't know what to say. I mean, and then I found out later my volunteers did this behind my back. They wrote this thing up and I submitted to where, and I was really, you know, it's really, I'm overwhelmed, actually, you know. I think it's going to be great.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I've never had anything done like this before, so it's really...
Well, you're well-deserving, and hats off to AWARE for the program at large.
Oh, yeah, it's a good... AWARE is really good,
In this case, the honor for you. So you're with one of three other women on Saturday? So
yeah,
this year's class is for honorees. And Sarah Lynn, you want to add anything? I mean, we've been talking a little bit here. Is there a piece you want to add to this?
Well, I appreciate you asking and recognizing that all that Betty's been talking about with Helping Hands is purely volunteer. And, you know, she works a 40-hour-a-week job. It's kind of remarkable. And, you know, sometimes people say, how do you decide who to choose? Or, you know, but then you hear things like this, and it makes it easy to choose sometimes.
Mm-hmm. So you have to, Betty, you have to make a presentation, right, at the bank?
Right, right.
You have to get up in this.
I'm working on it.
I've been there. It's this large, I don't want to scare you or anything, but it's this wonderful event.
Yes, it is. And you're
being honored.
Very good, yeah.
Are you, without giving anything away, do you know what you're going to talk about or say?
Oh, not really. I'm still working on it. We'll find it. We'll dig out something.
Well, I think just your basic story is
inspiring
enough.
Yeah, just how I'm about and stuff, you know. And,
mm-hmm.
and I do relay, and I volunteer for the Moose Lodge a little bit. I cook over there on a Thursday night for them and stuff, and so it keeps me busy.
You have a long history of giving in a lot of other ways,
yes,
above and beyond
yes,
your 40-hour-a-week paying
yes.
job and your 40-hour-a-week volunteer
yes.
job.
Yes.
Yeah, worthy of the recognition. Sarah Lynn, Saturday night, give the audience, for people who have not attended in the past, do you want to give them a feel for what the evening is like, what the event is like?
Sure. It opens with, right, the silent auction, and we have great things, by the way, adventures, art, experiences. It's I think, one of the best auctions you can find in town. And we have the women who speak about what has inspired them. The other honorees are Sherry Paul, Ernestine Hayes, and Lorraine Durr. So we've got a beautifully diverse group who will speak about that. There, we have music to start with Taylor Vidic singing an opening song for us. Angelina Ahrens is our MC, and it's really a very fun event. For a good time, come on, we dress up a little bit,
and Betty,
so it's a nice opportunity.
And Betty, you're one of the stars.
Thank you.
She sure is.
Well, anything else either of you wanted to add today before we kind of switch gears here on the interviews?
Maybe I will add that if you would like to get a ticket, please do so. You would want to contact AWARE at 586-6623. Tickets are $70. If you'd like to just show up at the event, you're welcome to do that, although you'd be taking a chance on whether or not there would be a seat available.
Mm-hmm. Betty, your story is very inspiring, and congratulations on the honor.
Thank you.
And I think you're going to have a wonderful evening Saturday being recognized by the community. So thank you both for coming in.
I'm getting excited about it.
Well, good. You should be.
Thank you,
Jamie.
Thank you both.
Yeah.
Pleasure.
This is Bird Note. On a winter morning in the Central American tropics, the sun rises. In a clearing, surrounded by dense forest, stand the ruins of a Mayan city. And on the warming air, this song. Perched beside its nest is the author of those gurgling tones, a Montezuma Orapendula. He sings again, this time with a sound like the pop of firecrackers. The 20-inch-tall male Montezuma Orapendula is feathered in rich chestnut brown. He's an oversized cousin of orioles, wielding a sharp spike of a bill tipped in red. As his song display begins, he grasps a branch in his feet, bows forward, and then hangs completely upside down, wings fluttering. His long tail becomes clearly visible, bright yellow, pointing upward. Our Orapendula is now suspended head downward, swinging by his feet, singing. His tail describes a golden pendulum, the source of his name in Spanish, Orapendula. You can learn more and see a photo of an Orapendula on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
The Juno Unitarian Universalist Fellowship is a welcoming congregation embracing many different beliefs and invites the community to join them on Sundays at 10 a.m. at the Temple Sukkot Shalom on Cordova Street in Douglas. More information is at juuf.org. This message brought to you by the Juno Unitarian Universalist Fellowship.
And in the studio, we have two folks, two principals from the Juno Lyric Opera. John Clow and Scarlett Adams are in the studio. Welcome to you both. Good to see you.
Thanks,
here.
Jamie. Good to see you.
And I realize that the next big event on your agenda to promote and talk about is?
It is auditions for a big show we're putting on next year, and it's The Man of La Mancha, the classic Broadway musical. And we're having auditions this weekend, starting Saturday, March 7th. We've got audition slots still available starting about 2 or so in the afternoon, and we're really wanting to talk to people out there in Juneau and tell them about that process and encourage them to come join us.
That's right. We'd like to see you. We want to hear you sing. We want to see you act. We want you up on stage for this wonderful show.
So you folks have been doing this 40 years, right? Is that correct?
Our 40th season is coming up,
This is our 40th anniversary season for Juno Lyric Opera.
Well, congratulations on that.
There's a whole
many amazing institutions in the capital city that started around 40 years ago, and yours is one of them.
Although, when you say you folks, please don't point at Scarlett and I when you say that. I have not been doing this for 40 years.
Sometimes it feels like it.
Thank God for the predecessors, right?
Yes, and some of which are still on the board. They've been there there for a long time.
So I know over the years, clearly you have established participants, singers, people who
right.
maybe are regulars, yet you're, I'm sure, always looking for new talent. And how do you go about cultivating and recruiting and finding that new talent to step up?
Well, first of all, it's always a challenge, partly because there's so many great things going on in the arts community here in Juneau.
Oh,
and people
yeah.
start maybe performing or singing with one organization. They kind of get used to and comfortable with that. And they don't think, oh, I could also go over here and do something with these other folks. And that's why one of the things we really want to talk about today is, hey, if you've worked with Perseverance or Theater in the Rough or with Todd or some of the other groups, we would still love to have you come talk to us and audition to be in one of our shows.
Absolutely.
This is a community you can cross over and do stuff with different outfits. And it's still to a remarkable degree. It's word of mouth, you know, sending out emails and Facebook notices, you know, modern word of mouth,
mm-hmm.
and just letting people know, hey, we're doing this neat show and we're going to have some auditions, and would you be interested in coming? And we wanted to take this opportunity to sort of get that word of mouth out over the air.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
In an old traditional way, radio.
There you go, the old fashioned.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, remarkably effective to this day.
For our community, it's fabulous.
Fortunately.
So, if someone's listening out there, first of all, they should know something about this play. Anything, Scarlett?
Oh, yes.
You know, Man of La Mancha is a fantastic Broadway musical. It was expected to run less than 1 month. It ran something like 2,400 consecutive performances, almost all of which were sold out. That's
Five
what a great
Tonys.
Hit. It was when it came on. It's based on really the first real novel in Western literature, which is Cervantes' mm-hmm. Don Quixote mm-hmm. story. And so this is the story of Don Quixote, and it's a play within a play, because Cervantes casts himself as the lead role in this, and he is imprisoned in the Spanish Inquisition. And he walks into the jail, and the first thing the other prisoners do is steal everything he owns. Except for one thing he's able to hold on to. It's this manuscript. It's what he had written. And it's the most precious thing in his life. And he makes this bargain with his fellow prisoners. He wants a trial to see whether he should be allowed to keep the manuscript. And he says, and for my trial, we will act out a play telling the story of my manuscript, and you will be the actors. And so the prisoners join him and start performing this play within a play. It's funny. It's sad, it's heartbreaking, it's really comedic at times, but gosh, it's great literature, great drama, and a great musical.
Mm-hmm. So, I agree.
Talk about the women's roles in this, too.
Well, there's the iconic role of Aldonza, the whore. And she's, of course, Quixote's Dulcinea. And I think the exciting thing about Aldonza is she's such a sad, sad character, but in the end, she finds herself, and she finds pride, and she goes on. And, you know, that big song that he sings to dream the impossible dream, it really affects her as well in the end. And I think it's very uplifting. It's very exciting.
Auditions, again,
Ooh.
Coming up. Let's make sure people
yes.
don't have this on their, you know, if they don't already know about it.
They're going to know about it right now, because this is a really simple process. First of all, if you're listening, everything you're going to hear Scarlett and I tell you about these auditions is on the Juno Lyric Opera website. So just look up Juno Lyric Opera, and on that go to upcoming events, and underneath that you'll find the Man of La Mancha auditions with all this stuff written down. But the auditions are going to be, they're from 10 through 4 on Saturday, but we've already filled the audition slots from 10 to 2, so it'll be, the remaining slots are from 2 to 4, and it's a very simple process. Scarlett, you're one of the people that's going to audition. Tell them what you're going to have to do for this.
I'm going to throw myself out there. What the heck? So basically, you need to come with first call and set a time so that we have space for you, and come and sing for us. We want you to do a 2-minute song of your choice, anything you want. We don't want it to be the music for Man of La Mancha for your audition. Give us something else.
Anything you'd like to sing.
Yes, anything that you love to sing. And bring your music for the accompanist. We're very lucky. We have Sue Kazama playing for us mm-hmm. on Saturday. So bring your music. Sing for 2 minutes, and then we'd like to also hear you do a 1-minute monologue. And if you've got it memorized, great. If not, you're certainly welcome to hold it and read from it if that's where you're at.
It can be a scene from a play. It can be a dramatic reading from a book. Just anything that shows how you like to how you sound when you emote the written word. I think that's the magic words we like to use.
Exactly. And then after the auditions on Saturday, they will make some decisions, and there will be callbacks that you will hear about immediately that evening for the following day. So definitely check the website, make a phone call, get your time scheduled with John, and come see us. We can't wait to hear you.
So how many parts are available? Is there a big cast? I mean, give it a sense for...
There's a lot of speaking parts available, probably a dozen or more speaking parts. And our director, Hal Ryder, who a lot of you out there have seen his work before, because he did The Mikado for us, and especially he did Hairspray back in 2012, which anybody in Juneau who saw Hairspray knows what an amazing director Hal Ryder is. But Hal really sees this as an ensemble cast, where almost all the cast will be on stage almost all the time. Mm. So even if you're not speaking at that moment, you're part of the action and part of what's going on. So we're probably going to end up between 18 to 20 people, maybe total on stage. It could be a few more, not many more, but you're going to be on stage for almost the whole show, and you'll be part of the action because, again, there's always these plays within plays going on.
Right, whether you're a named character or just part of the chorus that's on the stage, you may play one or two roles, so there's lots of opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely lots of opportunity, and Hal as a director is fantastic to work with. The reason we're doing the auditions this weekend is Hal will be up with us. He'll be here and reviewing the auditions himself. Richard Moore from JDHS is going to be our music director, so he and Hal will be the primary audition panel, and you know, they're pretty two laid-back guys, so it'll be, you know, everybody has nerves, Scarlett and I included, when you walk in to do an audition, but really this is about as low-key as it can get, and we're going to do it at Resurrection Lutheran Church, and all you have to do is call me at 209-7901, and I look at the big list and pencil your name down, and you'll be in and out of there in 15 minutes and maybe on your way to being in the show.
Everybody has to have nerves, right?
Oh,
isn't that what an audition
absolutely.
Is all about, putting yourself out there?
A combination of nerves and guts.
So I don't want to cut off the discussion about the auditions or Man of La Mancha, but you want to share a little bit just about the season, other things you're involved with, other things that you're doing?
We've got some big things coming
up. Take it.
Well, I'll do the gala, you do Don Giovanni. How about that?
I'll do the gala, you do Don Giovanni.
There we go. Do the gala, that's it.
Okay, so we have our annual fundraiser coming up, our big gala this year on April 17th. We're having it at Centennial Hall this year, and it's going to be wonderful. The theme will sort of be a Spanish theme because we're going to highlight some of the singers from Don Giovanni. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be wine tasting, there'll be a bar, there's going to be a dessert auction, and tapas from one of our restaurants in town. We're very excited about the night. Dress up. Come and enjoy the night.
Yeah, and you know, Don Giovanni, that means Don Juan, so it's a Don Juan theme, and this is the classic story of, you know, the Don Juan with 1,000 conquests, and what does that mean for him and the various ladies in his life? And so that is going to be our next big show. It premieres just 1 week later on April 24th at the Jack, with performances on the 24th and the 25th at the Jack. Tickets are already on sale at the Jack and on our website, so you can look for that, and we're very excited because we're taking this show over to Sitka as well. So the following weekend, it's going to be performing at the Sitka Performing Arts Center, which is just a fabulous facility for any of you that have ever been over there. So it's going to be 1 weekend here in Juneau and then the next weekend in Sitka. And that is truly a star-studded cast. We have opera singers coming from all over North America to join us. It is the kickoff show for our 40th anniversary season, and we wanted to do something very special, and I promise you that one is.
John Clough and Scarlett Adam, thank you very much, both of you, for coming in today, Juneau Lyric Opera, talking about auditions for Man of La Mancha, another wonderful event you're producing for the capital city here. I appreciate your taking the time to come in and speak to folks on the radio.
Thanks, Jamie.
Thank you so much.
To dream the impossible dream. To fight the unbeatable foe. To bear with unbearable sorrow.